Portland, a part of the Buy in Portland organization. If people want to know more, you can go to my program page at kboo.fm. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
That'll wrap it up.
Oh, you're slick, you investors in hate. You Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes. You billionaire bullies, you a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done, war after war. You old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language, you creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation, it's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers, you gambler thieves. You profit on war, you think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done, time after time, country after country, and crime after crime. You pretend it's religion, like there's no one to blame for the dead and impoverished in your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. You got the world's greatest power, and you team up with thugs, make a fortune on weapons, destruction and drugs. But your flags and boots and uniforms, they start to all smell the same when all sides are killing in the Patriot game. And that's how it's done. And
you're listening to KBO Portland 90. You're listening to KBO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m. Next up is Flashpoints.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program at kboo.org to learn more. That's program at kboo.org.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio, a production of the Coast Range Association. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. This September marks 2 years since the traumatic 2020 Labor Day fires that ravaged Oregon communities from the coast to the Cascades. I know I'll never forget that weekend, and I know plenty of folks who lost their homes or had to evacuate that weekend. And I want to start today by acknowledging that many of the victims of those fires remain without their houses, not whole, and still trying to rebuild their lives. So fire is and always has been a permanent part of our Western landscapes and ecosystems. But the debate and policy prescriptions around how to protect our communities is shockingly disconnected from the science and on-the-ground reality. And that's why I've invited the director of an amazing and powerful new film called Elemental onto the show to talk about the realities of how we can coexist with fires. Trip Jennings is the principal and founder of Balance Media, a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year, and has won dozens of awards for his past films. His new film, Elemental, has been met with rave reviews and is changing the narrative around wildfires. He's also a good friend of mine. The website, by the way, is elementalfilm.com, and I'm honored to welcome Trip Jennings to the show. Quick note, if you like what you hear, you can find all of our shows and more at coastrange.org. And we're also on all the podcast apps at Coast Range Radio. And if you have any feedback or suggestions, my email is michael@coastrange.org. All right, Trip Jennings, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks for having me, Michael. This is fun to chat with you in this context.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, you and I are longtime friends, and I know how hard you've worked for years on this project. So first of all, congratulations. I think the film is a huge accomplishment. And so I'm wondering, you know, what compelled you to sacrifice so much of your time making this film? And how would you describe Elemental to somebody who hasn't heard about it yet?
Yeah, well, I guess first off, I mean, Elemental is basically my journey for 5 years in trying to answer the question, how do we live and thrive in a hotter world that is burning more than we're used to, more than we have experienced for a few generations, right? And I think, you know, you can go watch a lot of documentaries about the state of the world and how the world is changing and leave very depressed. And I am somewhat surprised because honestly, this film comes with a pretty positive and a pretty, I think, doable message and sort of a path forward. And, you know, we've been showing it a lot in Oregon, and people, even people who survived some of the most traumatic and terrifying events of their lives in 2020 during the Labor Day fires, are really leaving, I think, with a new perspective, but also pretty energetic and pretty inspired. Because, you know, I think that fire is a difficult, profoundly complicated element, but we can live and thrive with it as part of our ecosystems.
Yeah, and that seems to be one of the overarching messages of the film. Could you talk a little bit more about some of the reactions you've had? Because I know that you've shown the film in some of these areas where communities have been devastated by these wildfires. How have folks, especially folks like policymakers and then people who've been affected on the ground, been reacting to the film?
Well, I mean, one of the most, you know, meaningful, I think, part of this process has really been showing the film to people who experienced these fires, who had to evacuate. And, you know, just one of the people that really stands out is Ron Carmichael, the mayor of Gates, Oregon, you know, a small town in the San Juan Canyon that, I mean, it mostly burned to the ground. And he lost his house. And, you know, I was nervous to show it to people who deeply experienced some of the things that are in it, right? I mean, it's like, it's a huge responsibility to tell someone else's story. And he just said he watched it once and he said he loved it. And then he watched it like 5 more times. He felt a lot of hope after watching it. And that's part of what we're hearing over and over. Part of that's because one of the things we did is we went into a lot of these ecosystems and we did document the recovery. You know, we documented the fact that even in one of the most extreme fires this part of the state has seen in 100 years, you know, within one, you know, 2 seasons, there's a lot of green coming back, right? And there's still animals using those landscapes. And a lot of animals love burned landscapes. But it's not just the ecosystem. I mean, you know, I think there's really concrete steps that people can take as they rebuild. And as we learn from people who've had to rebuild, how to not have to experience this again, how to be more prepared and be ready, because fires are going to keep coming. And so that's like, that's the message that I hope everyone can take away, right? Is like the adaptation to fire is within our reach. And I mean, you know, maybe get back to some of their first questions, like, why did we make the film? And a lot of that is, you know, after the Eagle Creek fire, not as devastating, right? Really just in the forest. But we really saw this disconnect between the best available science and the conversations that were happening both in the media and on, you know, social media and just friends. And since 2017, the Eagle Creek Fire, Oregonians have learned so much about fire because we've just experienced it. started to get used to this idea that every couple of years we're going to be sucked in by smoke, right? And unfortunately, I think because we have that constant reminder, there is this pervasive fear that we have to do something. And that's true, but a lot of the money that we're spending, both at the state and federal level, are going in a direction that I think is probably not helping communities stay safe, and also, in many cases, maybe taking us in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of directions I want to take this conversation, but since we are kind of talking about policy and the politics around it, maybe let's stay on that track for now. You mentioned the Eagle Creek fire. One thing that I was shocked by there was seeing then Congressman Greg Walden propose expansive logging throughout the entire Columbia Gorge scenic area in response to that. And it just seemed like a shocking kind of political maneuver to exploit people's fear around it. And I just wonder if you could talk more about how the Eagle Creek fire kind of influenced your thinking around fire, and it sounds like maybe your decision to start working on this project.
Yeah, I mean, the Eagle Creek fire was the genesis of this for me. It burned about 40,000 acres in a place that has just been so important to me over the last 20 years of living in Oregon. You know, I have like, honestly, I feel like there are just parts of the gorge that feel more like a relative, like a sibling, or, you know, someone I go visit when I just need to like ground. I think many Oregonians had that same relationship with the gorge, right? And I think what people really couldn't see from the river level in the gorge is the fact that, you know, 3/4 or more of that fire was low intensity. Many of the trees were just barely licked by flames and they were green. And so I got the only exemption to fly through the TFR, the temporary flight restriction, took all these photos, and then they were published in the Oregonian. It was the cover of the Oregonian the next day with the title, "The Gorge Hasn't Lost Its Green." You know, it feels very different, I think, to many people if it's like, oh my gosh, 40,000 acres of trees are all dead. And that's just not the way fire works on a landscape, right? So that was, you know, I was just like, okay, there's a huge disconnect between the way we think about fire and the way fire has always been on the landscape. I set out thinking that I was going to make a film about fire is a part of the ecosystem, and, you know, actually we just need more of it. We should go do a lot of prescribed burning. And the film really took a very significantly different turn. There was this moment less than a year after the Eagle Creek fire when one of the researchers said to me, "Nothing you do farther than 100 feet from the home has very much effect at all on whether that home burns down if it comes in contact with a fire." And I thought, wow, that guy is definitely wrong. Like, that can't be true. And so I kind of spent like 3 more years researching that idea. But since the Eagle Creek fire, my perspective really shifted in terms of what we need to do regarding fire and looking at it from a home out perspective rather than a forest in perspective. And the film goes through a lot of the research. I think it's an accessible way to get pretty deep into the science on how we actually change the narrative to think about the home out rather than the forest in.
I think the way you just described it is such a perfect way of encapsulating the approach that you take in the film Elemental. And I do want to talk more about the kind of policy prescriptions and the mismatch between the policy, public perception, and the science. But I maybe want to actually step back and talk more about Elemental for a minute. I think you really stuck to this compelling combination of showcasing the science and then highlighting the real stories of people impacted by fires. So could you talk about your decision-making process around kind of how you framed the narratives that you wanted to present?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think that the science speaks for itself. And we've really come a long way, I think, scientifically, in terms of our understanding of like the nuances of fire and, you know, the paradoxes of fire. And to distill that, to bring that into a narrative, what we really wanted to do was meet most folks where they are, right? And through the experiences of some of the most, you know, capable firefighters in the world and some of the foremost, you know, experts and researchers on fire, really think about the narrative and really think about our understanding, because the stories that we hear about fire, the stories that we hear about survivors, really, I think, shape the way the public thinks about it. I hope that this film lives and is able to really like touch people in a longer term way than one policy change will.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So first of all, I just wonder if you could run down like two or three key takeaways, especially in terms of the mismatch between kind of traditional wildfire quote-unquote management and what the best available science says, like you're talking about in terms of home hardening versus, you know, backcountry thinning of in the national forests, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I'll just give the sort of briefest rundown that I can, I think, because it's not that complicated, but there's some nuance. So first off, what we're doing and what we have been doing as our primary tactic to reduce fire risk to communities has been to reduce the amount of burnable material in forests by and large. So that means thinning, and if we're lucky and we get to it, doing a prescribed burn afterwards. And there's currently a few $100 million for, you know, coming down the federal pipeline to support that kind of project.
Actually, let's just hold on that for a second. Why is thinning in the backcountry not supported by the science? Why is that the wrong perspective?
Right. So the short answer is that when scientists look at homes that came in contact with fire, so they had the opportunity to burn down, and they look at homes that survived and homes that didn't across the country, there's no signal, or a very, very weak signal, of their proximity to any sort of fuels treatment. So that's sort of jargony. What I'm trying to say is, if you're doing activities that are farther than 100 feet from the home, they have very little or no effect on the burnability, the ignitability, whether or not the home burns down. So whether or not thinning is successful at controlling or modifying fire behavior is irrelevant to the home. And we really didn't get into the, you know, is thinning ever justified? Sure, yeah, there are dry forests that may need some thinning. I think, you know, where a lot of the listeners to this live on the Coast Range, there's very little, if any, scientific justification for thinning for fire risk reduction, because, you know, the Coast Range is, you know, if you're not in the far southwest corner of Oregon, you're in a pretty wet area. And I say that just to illustrate that there's so many different forest types across the country that we can't just say like, oh, let's thin and that will work across the landscape. Also, the majority of homes that burn in the United States aren't in forests. So if we're, you know, if our goal is to protect homes and communities and we're thinning forests and trying to modify the fire behavior in homes that aren't even surrounded by forests, like, it's not gonna work, right? In California, in fact, 80% of the homes that burn are not in forests. So we have to obviously focus on something else, because it's not forests that are burning them down.
Right, so that's a perfect place to say, what should people be focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, the major shift, I think, in the understanding of how homes burned happened when, you know, researchers started to realize that it's not a flaming front that moves through a community and burns a home down and then burns the next home. It's embers that are flying, you know, feet to miles in front of the fire, and they're finding small nooks and crannies in people's houses that ignite and burn the entire home down. So the most important thing that you can control, and every homeowner and even some renters to some degree have some control over this, but it's the ignitability of the home and its ember exposure, right? So it, to some degree, it's building design and materials, but it's also covering your attic vents with mesh. It's cleaning your gutters. It's making sure that there is a 5-foot non-combustible perimeter around your house so that when embers do blow from a fire, maybe they hit your siding and they drop to the sort of corner, you know, that your house makes with the ground, ignite a leaf and burn the home down that way. And so it is these little things, and there's a reasonably, you know, good list in order of priority of what you can do. And some of them cost a few cents or a few dollars, like attic vent covers. Some of them are free, like cleaning your gutters. Others do take some investment, like multi-pane windows, especially if they're tempered. But if you think about it like this, the reason that you want multi-pane windows is that most homes burn in high wind events. High wind events can blow something into your window, crack one little pane, an ember can blow into your house and burn it from the inside out. It's the same concept with attic vents, right? Like if you have the little attic vents on your eaves, they suck an ember inside of your house and it burns it from the inside out. It's much less likely that your siding is going to catch on fire. And if you have an asphalt roof, which most people have, you know, a class A roof that is non-combustible, that's fine. That's enough. You don't need a metal roof. As long as you don't have wood shingles, it is those little things. So it's all about ember penetration. And then that 5-foot perimeter around your house, we basically just need to simply flip our relationship with our garden beds and our walkways. So if you just have that concrete walkway next to your house instead of your garden bed, or if you have river stones, something nice and, you know, ornamental like that, that's relatively easy to just sweep out, that's what's going to keep your house from burning down, changing the ignitability of it.
Actually, so I'm sure you are tracking this. This year, the Oregon Department of Forestry released a statewide wildfire risk assessment map, only to withdraw it soon afterwards after public outcry. I personally don't understand how to think about that. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about the risk assessment map and then the withdrawal of it.
Yeah, well, I think that the people who created the map, some of them are in the film. I have extremely high degrees of trust in their work, and they worked very hard on it for quite a while. So in a state, you know, that's as large as Oregon, with as many homes that are exposed to fire, sure, maybe there are a few things that could be tweaked. I really do trust the people who created that map, so I think that it probably has a lot of value as it stood. You know, I went out and talked to a lot of property owners right after the map came out who were like, yeah, we're in high risk. We've known the risk was high, and now we have a map telling us that. Like, it's good to know, it's good to quantify the risk. Their risk didn't change because there's a map. It's just that we now have called it what it is, and I think that's the first step to actually preparing our state. And I also want to say that, you know, State Bill 762 was, I think, one of the most progressive and best pieces of fire legislation, certainly in the United States and probably in the world. And I really hope that it continues to move forward. It certainly is continuing to move forward. I hope that the wildfire map continues to move forward. There's great stuff in that bill for people who lost their homes. There's grant programs to do hardening as people rebuild. What there's not yet is subsidies for people who might be required to do modifications to their homes and property. But there's a lot of talk about different ways to subsidize that and do it. And honestly, like, it has to be subsidized. We can't just have wealthy people, you know, protect their homes and then people who can't afford it, people who are renters, not be protected from wildfires. So certainly there's work to do there, but I mean, they are absolutely moving forward quickly with figuring out the equity issues, figuring out how to subsidize people, you know, work on people's homes. It's, you know, it's a groundbreaking bill. There's nothing like this in existence. It's going to take some figuring out. And I'm not saying just trust the government. You'll never hear me say that. But I think that there are some very sympathetic people who are very smart, who are moving this stuff forward in a way that's going to be great, especially if we keep them in office and especially if we keep pressure on them.
And I should note real quick that Senate Bill 762 was passed into law last session, though the implementation is still an ongoing process. And that bill aside, the politics and policy of fire are still often very disconnected from the science. Why do you think that is? And what role does timber industry propaganda play in that?
Well, I mean, I think that there's no question that, you know, the industry has been pushing a narrative for generations that they know how to take care of the forest. And if we just let them manage it, it'll be okay. And the 2020 fires laid that bare. Like, that's clearly wrong. If that was true, then, you know, the overwhelming majority of the Holiday Farm fire, which is private land and most of it private industrial land, those homes would have fared a lot better if the industry knew how to take care of our forests in a way that made us less at risk. But it just didn't happen. I mean, Blue River burned to the ground. It's surrounded by timber plantations. It actually, and we talk about this in the film, it makes us less safe to have clear cuts and to have timber plantations around communities especially, but they burn hotter. And so the timber industry in Oregon has very successfully controlled the way they pay taxes to minimize their taxes, and the taxes that they do pay go into basically a marketing firm for the timber industry. And they are constantly telling Oregonians that the best way to manage for fire is to let industry do their thing, to cut and cut and cut. And it's just wrong. It's not supported by the science. We can't cut our way out of this. And instead, we need to accept that fire on the landscape is always going to happen. And sometimes it's going to be high intensity. You know, I will say we have an important choice to make this fall in the governor's race. We have, I don't think you can always just vote for a party or a candidate and make an issue better, although sometimes it's true that that's possible. And I will say that I actually think that Tina Kotek is starting to listen to the science when it comes to wildfire. And I think that Betsy Johnson is truly not. She's supported by the timber industry. She's come out and said that if she's elected, you know, we'll see more logging and more of the same kind of efforts and money spent on things that just don't get us where we need to go. They won't make communities safer. And I mean, I see there being strong potential to collaborate with the timber industry in making us safer, but it's not in doing more of business as usual. We see where that's gotten us, and it's grim. It's devastating. Believing that the timber industry is our way out of this will just lead to more 2020 disasters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the timber industry, especially when we're talking about here in Western Oregon, where the vast majority of private timberland is owned by Wall Street shell companies, like, their short-term profit motives. They don't care about our communities. They don't care about whether our homes burn or not. So, Tripp, is there anything, as we start to wrap up, is there anything that I've missed or that you want to make sure gets included in this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say is, like, firefighters put out 98% of fires. And that's amazing. We are so good at it. And it's that 2% that gets out and destroys homes and communities. And man, you know, I've heard so many stories of the heroic activities of firefighters. And, you know, I love standing on stage and doing question and answer sessions with firefighters who are excited to collaborate on this sort of thing, right? And I love standing on stage with survivors who are excited to rethink and rebuild our communities and people who live in high-risk areas. And just traveling around the state over the last couple of months has been, it's so encouraging. I mean, people want to do something proactive. And I think starting that conversation by coming and watching this film has been a fun, generative way to do that. And I hope to get to do that with so many people who are listening to this podcast, and on the radio as well. And we have a bunch of screenings coming up in the next few weeks in Oregon. I would love to see people out at theaters. September 28th, we're in Florence. September 29th, we're in Bandon. September 30th, we're up the McKenzie River, the McKenzie River Community Center. And then October 6th, we're in Coos Bay. So lots of opportunities, especially if you're on the coast, to see these, the film. It will be coming out for streaming in 2023 after we do the sort of the rest of this theatrical push. That's what we really need, I think, to change the way we're having this conversation about fire. So look for it. Elementalfilm.com is our website. All of our screenings are posted under the screenings tab. And if you want to do a screening, if you're excited about showing it to your community, drop us a line. There's a contact form on there. Just send us an email.
That's our show. Huge thanks to Trip Jennings for talking with me, and I urge everyone listening to see Elemental. If you want to learn more, you can find extensive links and resources, including links to the film website, the Oregon Wildfire Risk Assessment Map, and more in our show notes and at coastrange.org, where you can also learn about the work and the mission of the Coast Range Association. If you like our show, help us reach more people. Tell a